So today we are going to finish the analysis, the canonical analysis of the 3D gravity action, the first order action. So yeah, so we already seen that the equation of motion are constrained, but so we are going to study in more detail this constraint. In particular, we're going to look at the constrained algebra, and then we will be ready for next week to start looking at quantization of constrained system, and then in particular start quantization of 3D gravity, okay? So this is the 3D action written when we consider that the manifold can be written as a 2D surface times the real line. So we're here now for to recall the notation, the A, B indices are spatial indices, and so the I, G are still the internal indices, okay? So from this action, you get one canonical pair of variables, which is so the triad, the densitized triad, okay? And so EBK is just equal to epsilon BCECK. Okay, and so then this is the connection. So all other Poisson brackets are vanishing. And you can see here that these two variables are just as a linear action here, and there is no time derivative. Okay, so these two variables are considered as here are in fact just Lagrange multiplier. And I'm going to rewrite the two equations of motion we obtain from varying from these two Lagrange multipliers, which are in fact constrained because there is no time derivative appearing here in this. Okay, so it's exactly constrained on the surface. So let me write them again. So we get as equation of motion, we get these two equations which are constrained because there is no time derivative. So Fi, which is just so 1/2 of ABJ contracted with the Ivici-Vita tensor. And in terms of coordinate, you get, I'm going to need it, so I'm going to recall what is this expression here, because we are going to use it right after, plus 1/2 of ALB. Okay, so this comes from the variation of your action with respect to this variable. Then if we vary with the with respect to the connection here, we get what we're going to call the Gauss constraint, which also appear in the Young-Mills theory, okay, and which is 1/2 of T A B I. So here if a J epsilon A B, and in terms of coordinates, you can rewrite this as, so this has to be equal to 0. And in terms of the densitized triad, which is our fundamental variable here, we get this expression. So, and I recall that now the connection, I denoted the connection A and not omega anymore, okay? So this is really the same connection we used before. And so this one is what we are going to call the flatness constraint. And here we get the Gauss constraint. Okay, so now let's have a look to what we call the phase space. So these variables are defining what we call the phase space. And let's see what this means that now we have constraint on the phase space. Okay, so let's assume that this is our phase space. Okay, so it's a set well, not very. So it's a set of phase-based variables are this connection coordinate and the densitized triad here. And so this defines a phase space with this canonical Poisson bracket. And we can see that, in fact, here, since we have constraint, we are going to call that at this stage, when you just deal with this variable and only the Poisson bracket associated to this variable, we call about the kinematical phase space. And to go to what we are going to call the physical phase space, we need to deal with the constraint. So the kinematical phase space are described by this variable and the associated Poisson bracket. Okay, and so here we can start by doing a kind of counting of degrees of freedom. So A here is just a spatial component. Okay, so it can take two values, and J is also the spatial component, the internal component. Okay, so we get, yeah, so it's two, yeah, it's two times three, so it's six here and six here too, okay? I don't know why on my paper I didn't do this counting of degrees of freedom, so hopefully at the end I will get the right result because I don't know what I did here. Okay, so we'll see if this work or if I did something wrong. And so, but here it's not the end of the story because we have this constraint which act on the on your phase space variable. Okay, so this means that only phase space points in the constrained hypersurface. So it's a, so I'm going to this here draw kind of hypersurface. Okay, and so here it's when the constraints are satisfied. So it's point in the phase space that has the constraints are satisfied. And this is our constrained hypersurface. So what is it? Okay, so here we have three Gauss constraints and three flatness constraints. So the dimension of the constraint, so here it's a constrained hypersurface. So the, here, the constraint hypersurface is described by these two constraints. And so its dimension here is, so the dimension, you have three constraints here and three constraints here. So it's 12 minus 6, so you get 6. Okay, but so then this is not really, again, the end of the story. But now we need, so first what I'm going to do with this constraint, I'm going to see what is the interpretation of this constraint. Okay, so I'm going to look at the flow of this generated by this constraint. And then we also need to check that, so yeah, these constraints are going to generate a flow, okay? And we want to check that the flow of this constraint remain on the hyper constraint hypersurface. Okay. Otherwise, this means that when you have an evolution with your constraint for your variable, then this means that you go out of the hypersurface, and so this means that additional constraints are needed. So we need to check that the hypersurface is conserved by the by our constraint here, okay? So this is the two step now we're going to look at. So we want to first, what is the interpretation of our constraint? So what I mean by this is, what are the symmetry generated by this constraint, okay? And then we need to look at to check that the flow of the constraint is on the constraint hypersurface. And so for this, we will have to look at the constraint algebra. But so just before doing this, just let's come back. So if you remember from the point particle, we had that the action was the integral of so p q dot minus the Hamiltonian. So now by analogy here, we can say that the Hamiltonian, so by analogy with by p q dot minus h, here we can say that h is our integral from so EO, the flatness constraint, plus OJ of the Gauss constraint. And so this defines our Hamiltonian. And as you can see, the Hamiltonian here is just a sum of constraints. Okay? So this means that we have a, so here is just a sum of constraints. And so this kind of system where the Hamiltonian is just a constraint or a sum of constraints is called a totally constrained system. Okay, so here we are dealing, and this is a kind of feature of gravity, okay, a strange feature of gravity that we are dealing with a totally constrained system. Okay, so let's look at the interpretation of our constraint. So for this, I'm going to look at the Poisson bracket of our basic variable of our phase space with the constraint. So I want to look at the variation of our basic variable when by acting with a constraint. Okay? So, but for this, I need the first step is to regularize this constraint. Because in fact, if you look at this constraint and at the Poisson bracket that we have above, so you see that you have many, you have delta function. Okay? So when you're going to look at the constraint algebra or even just the flow of the constraint, and we are going to get derivative of delta, and we don't really like that, especially that, and we don't even like just delta function when we at the, when we want to quantize, okay? So the first step is a kind of regularization step is to smear the constraint, okay? And so this is the usual step. And so you are going to see then why it's interesting. So it's just because, yeah, you get better defined than just the pointwise constraint. And so here we're going to define the smeared Gauss constraint, where here lambda is can be any 3D vector. And the smeared flatness constraint. Okay, and so where is NJ? So here, yeah, so since you have a totally constrained system, this means that H, in fact, is equal to zero, but it can still generate a flow. And this is described by the Poisson bracket of any phase space function with H, and this gives you the infinitesimal change under the transformation generated by H. But here, I'm going to look at the infinitesimal transformation generated by each constraint individually, okay? So I'm going to first look at the transformation, infinitesimal transformation generated by the Gauss constraint and then by the flatness constraint on our basic phase space variable. I'm not going to consider a very complicated phase space function, but just this basic variables, and then we'll see what are the interpretation, what are the symmetry generated by our constraint. So let's start with the Gauss constraint. So maybe I'm going to go on the other side because I need some space here. to do this calculation. So what is the infinitesimal? Change associated. So any, I guess you have an idea of what I'm supposed to find here. So what are going to be the symmetry generated by the Gauss constraint? Any idea? So here, you know the symmetry of your action, okay? So we have the rotation and the translation and the diffeomorphism. But we know that we can write in 3D, what is very simple is that you can write diffeo as a combination of translation and rotation. So here we have the Gauss constraint. So do you have any idea what is going to generate? No? Okay, so let's see that together. You should see, you should recognize what is the transformation. So I'm going to look at the transformation for the densitized triad, but you should, at the end, I'm going to get a formula that we have already seen. So you should recognize it and tell me, okay, this is a infinitesimal. Okay, so let's look at this translation, this infinitesimal transformation. So this means that I want to look at the Poisson bracket of this variable with the smeared Gauss constraint. So here I'm going to use the smeared one, and I'm going to write it directly with the coordinate. Okay, so that's why I recall you the expression here. And so I get lambda k bk plus klm of ALB. So here it seems not B, B, M, okay. And this, of course, is at the y point of space-time, and then I'm integrating over y. Okay. So now I'm just going to, so the only non-zero Poisson bracket here with of E is with the A variable here, okay? So I just need to take care of this Poisson bracket here between these two variables. And so this means that I can simplify this, and I just get, so here I'm going to get a delta AB, a delta GL, okay, and a delta XY. So the delta XY is going to make the integral disappear, and then you can simplify all indices here, okay? So I'm just using the canonical Poisson bracket, so it's just a one-line calculation, and when you took care about this this simplification, you just get a m lambda k. So do you recognize this infinitesimal transformation here? Yeah, I think you have it, at least you. Okay, so it's an infinitesimal rotation here, and it's, we recognize the change of the triad we computed, I think, yesterday. So here it's just an internal infinitesimal rotation. So let's check now what is the transformation generated by, again, the Gauss constraint on now the connection. So again, I'm going to look at the Poisson bracket between but so here I'm going to perform an integration by part, okay? So because here I have A, and so it's going to be the same expression on the on this side of the Poisson bracket for here, and so you see that A is going to have a non-trivial Poisson bracket with the E variable and the E variable here only, but I don't really know what it is when I have the derivative of this variable, but since I'm dealing with smeared variable, or otherwise that's also why I would get some derivative of delta function, but here you can take care of that correctly doing a integration by part. Okay, so I'm going directly to write it like this. Lay AK, and then I have ABK plus epsilon K LM of B of Y. Okay, so now the only non-zero Poisson bracket are going to be between this term and this one. Okay, so again, I'm going just to get some delta function. And so at the end, I just obtain that the infinitesimal transformation of the connection is given by so a minus going out epsilon of x. Well, here you should also recognize from what the calculation we did, I think, yesterday or maybe 2 days ago, that it's also an internal, this also characterizes transformation of a connection under an internal rotation, infinitesimal rotation. So here we can conclude that on our phase space, the Gauss constraint generate internal rotation. And this is the same result you get in the Young-Mill gauge transformation. It's the gauge transformation, Young-Mill gauge transformation. So internal rotation. Okay, so this gives you the first, yeah. Okay, it's just because, so it's a regularization, okay? Otherwise, we are dealing with delta and then at some point with derivative of delta. And especially when you want then to quantize, you don't know how to quantize this kind of distribution, okay? So anyway, even, yeah, just in the idea to then quantize things, we are going to, it's the same. You will see that on Monday, even our variable here, we are going to smear our variable in order to have well-defined. We don't want to deal with this. Poisson bracket that we have, okay, the canonical. So we are going also to smear the variable in order to be able to quantize.
And then at the end, you take the limit to zero.
Sorry?
And then you, at the end, after the computation, take some limit to zero, or just
the remaining? No, you just keep, you. We are just now working with this, okay, because, yeah, it's just that, yeah, this is valid for any lambda and n, and in fact, you can. In the action, you can also say that yeah, this comes from the Lagrange multiplier that we have here. Okay.
Would there have to be test functions? So otherwise, we couldn't do this integration by part, right?
Yeah. If
the compact support.
If you don't have the smear, you cannot do the integration by part.
No, I mean the lambda and the n, they have to decay at infinity.
Yeah. Here you don't need any. Ah, you're right, yeah, because at the end you get the delta lambda e.
Are we dealing with compact spacetime? So
yeah.
It doesn't matter?
Yeah, here it's a. So here we're just dealing with. So we are on the special hypersurface, okay? So in fact, yeah, we will see what are the more in detail, especially then we will go to another parametrization of the constraint and see what are the interpretation of this function, and you can take any function. You know. Okay, so this was for the Gauss constraint. And so let's now look at the flatness constraint. So any idea of, so now you don't have so much choice because you already know that the Gauss constraint generates the internal rotation, so you're only left with, you don't have many other choice for the flatness constraint. So what do you see the flatness constraint is going to generate here?
Translations.
Yeah, good, thanks. Okay, so let's check that. So it's going to be the same kind of calculation. We just want to, so I'm just going to give you the result. So we just exactly get that the variation of the densitized triad is going to be characterized by translation MGMK AMEK, and then I need to keep track of, yeah, here we see. Okay. And of course, it's simple to see that the action of the flatness, the flow of generated by the flatness constraint on the connection is going to be zero, because the flatness constraint is only a function of the connection. And so the connection with the connection, of course, it's zero. Okay? So here, we just get that this is zero. Okay, so here we get that the flatness constraint generate translation and the translation symmetry.
Should that be an MK or something like this, not an EK?
Sorry?
Should that be an M, sorry, an NK in the end, not an EK? Because I don't know if E has two indices, right? And also, N is zero, this whole thing should be zero to the last term. I'm not sure what EK is.
Thanks for checking. Okay, very good. So, and we know that on shell, anyway, so we get that we know that the DFAO anyway can be written as a combination of translation and rotation. Okay, so it's not so surprising that to get explicitly here the DFAO. Okay, so now we have a nice interpretation of our constraint. So the next step is to check that our constraint hypersurface is preserved by the action of constraint. Okay, so let's that the constraint surface is invariant under the gauge transformation, so the rotation. And so for this, we need to check that the flow of the constraint for on another constraint is going to be equal to zero, at least on shell. Okay, so this means we need to compute the constraint algebra. We want to check that this constraint algebra is what we call a closed algebra, okay? So here, I'm going to start with the Gauss constraint algebra, okay? So let's first start with the Gauss constraint algebra. So I'm going to give you the different steps you need to compute this variable. So here we look at G for a lambda G of lambda, and we want to check that this is equal to zero, or it's equal to a combination of our constraint, because if it's the case, this means that on shell this is equal to zero. Okay? Okay, so I'm going already to do integration by part. Okay, so I'm going to want to have a look to B lambda prime K plus epsilon K L M lambda prime K A L B E B M. Okay, so I did already an integration by part here. And I want to look at the variation with okay, so I want to conclude this Poisson bracket. So here, what I'm going to do, I'm going to use what we just calculate here, okay? Because I know the Poisson bracket of E and A with a Gauss constraint. So I can directly write the result. Okay, so the second step is just to, so this was the first step here. You did an integration by part here. Then the second step here is to use just action of your Gauss constraint on your variable A and E. Okay, and so here, what you get here, you get three terms, okay, because you have the E here, the A here, and the E here, we're going to act on this, we're going to have a non-trivial Poisson bracket. So here, you get that this is the integral over lambda prime K of epsilon K M L of the flux variable. So this comes from the first term here. Then from the second term, you get minus epsilon K L M. So this from this one, lambda prime K from this one. And then now I'm looking at this Poisson bracket. And so I get that this is the derivative plus epsilon LQP, let's say, of ABQ. No. Let's keep the same that I have here, otherwise I'm going to get and B, no, sorry, lambda Q. Okay, so this is from this Poisson bracket and then E B. M, and I still have this third term coming from this one, so I get a minus epsilon K L M from this K L M, lambda prime K L B epsilon M, so what is the choice, P Q again, B Q and P lambda Q. Okay. Okay, so now we have to simplify this to show that, so what are you expecting? Okay, so we have a rotation and another rotation, so two rotations should give another rotation. Okay, so this means that we are expecting to simplify this to show that this is something like this with a new lambda. Okay, so then the third step is to simplify, and to simplify this, we're going to first do a new integration by part. Okay, here. And also, use the Jacobian identity for the structure constant for, so here, SU2, okay? Because you see that we have this kind of, so we are going to simplify this epsilon here. And so what is the, so here the third step is integration by part, plus use of the Jacobi identity so I'm going to recall what is it and then you can check by yourself that it's what I use to give you the final result so identity for the structure constant epsilon ijk of the rotation group, okay? So what is this identity? Let's move that a bit. So here's the identity. Hopefully I'm not going to. K L M L P Q plus epsilon P P. Okay, so if you use this, then you get that finally Poisson bracket between the Gauss constraint for lambda prime and lambda can be written as integral of lambda prime j j m l, and here you have what you expect from the expression of the Gauss constraint. B e I, so here I'm missing one index. And so, yeah, this is the Gauss constraint. So now this means that this is your new smearing parameter. Okay. And indeed, you get that here. This is the Gauss constraint with the new smearing parameter given by M G L prime J here you need to add an index. Okay, so this shows that the expecting result, because from two rotations you get another rotation. And in fact, so if you consider lambda here as Lie algebra valued, okay, element. In fact, so let me use another blackboard. So I'm going to keep these two blackboard because I'm going to come back on that. So let's just so here, if you consider that lambda prime are Lie algebra element, okay, so this means that you denote that you note that lambda is lambda I T I, where T I are the SU2 generator, okay, or SO3, Lie algebra generator, as you want, then you get that indeed lambda prime with lambda, the commutator, okay, is exactly given by L lambda L lambda K TL. Okay? And so this means that you can rewrite your Poisson bracket between as a new Gauss constraint where the new parameter is given by the Poisson, the commutator between this Lie algebra element. Okay, and so the Poisson algebra here, we said that the Poisson algebra of the Gauss constraint is a representation of the SU2 Lie algebra, okay, of Gauss constraint. Here is definition of the SU2 algebra. Okay, so this was for the Gauss constraint. So it's okay, the Poisson bracket between two Gauss constraints give another Poisson Gauss constraint. So on the constraint surface, it's equal to zero. And so now let's have a look to the flatness constraint. So the flatness constraint depends only on the connection, okay? So two flatness constraints, the Poisson bracket of two flatness constraints is going to be equal to the connection with the connection give. No, here you're going to get zero, okay? It's a kind of commutation because you have A with A. The Poisson bracket of two connection is zero. Okay, so you get that for the flatness constraint, since it's only a function of the connection, you get that the two are equal to zero. And so this also, it's what makes 3D gravity very simple, because so this means that we have something abelian, and it's always easier to impose. Okay, at the quantum level, it will be an abelian. Okay, so now the next step is to look at the flatness with the Gauss constraint. And so here, indeed, you what are you expecting? So you get a rotation and a translation. So what does it give here?
Translation.
Yeah, a rotated translation. Okay, so we're going to get a flatness of now the new. So I'm not, you can do explicitly, of course, the calculation and show that here we get the flatness constraint for this new smearing parameter, where here this means that lambda is rotating n, okay? So the Gauss constraint induces here an internal rotation on the internal index of the flatness constraint. And if you want to write this in terms of indices, you get that this is nj epsilon j mk of the flatness time the lambda k. And so this mirrors here indeed the commutation relation between a translation and a rotation, which give a rotated translation. Okay? And so to conclude here on the constraint algebra, we get that our constraint algebra so is quite nice because it's a what we call a closed algebra, and it's mirror here the semi-direct product of translation with rotation. So we get that again is just g of and with f is equal to zero. And here f of n that is equal to f of n lambda. And so this is what we get, a closed constraint algebra. So the Poisson bracket between the constraint here are linear combination of our constraint. Okay. And so let's go back to our phase space now. So when we have a closed algebra here, we say that the constraints are first class. Okay, so we have first class constraints. And this is usually the case, yeah, at least for physically interesting cases, it's when we have gauge transformation, you have a first class constraint system. Okay, so first class.
Is this constraint algebra isomorphic to the Poincaré algebra?
Yeah, exactly. It's mirror. So it's mirror here. It's here, since we are in the Euclidean case, it's the Euclidean. Exactly. So here it's really mirror this here algebra. So SO3. Okay, with a semi-direct product, meaning that the rotation of a non-trivial action on the translation. Exactly. Very good. Okay, so here we have a first class system, okay? And so this means that the Gauss transformation generated by the constraint preserves the constraint surface. Okay? And so any gauge transformation here is going to when you look at the flow of this gauge transformation, you get kind of trajectory here in your constraint surface. And now since we have checked that it's a closed algebra, this means that indeed this trajectory remains in the constraint hypersurface. Okay? So here, if you want, it's what we are going to call the gauge orbit. So it's just the flow generated by the gauge transformation. So this is a gauge orbit here. And so this means that points along this line, this gauge orbit here, are physically equivalent, okay? Because they are related by a gauge transformation. So they correspond to the same physical configuration. Only described, of course, in different coordinate systems. Okay, so this means that you have the same physically configuration, only in a different coordinate system. And then to select, so here we start with the kinematical phase space, okay, with all these variables. Then we have seen that this variable has to be constrained, so we obtain the constrained hypersurface. Then we've shown that on this constrained hypersurface, we have gauge orbit, for which each point on this gauge orbit are now physically equivalent. So this means that now if we want to select physical degrees of freedom, we have to divide by gauge orbit. Okay? And so in our case, gauge orbit span a six-dimensional manifold at each point. Okay? And so if we divide by, so first, before giving you the answer, but it's quite obvious, so how many degrees of freedom are we expecting to get here? In this case, we are talking with 3D gravity. So
none.
Yeah. Okay. So here we started with 12 degrees of freedom, but when I'm talking with 12 degrees of freedom, it's at each point of space-time. Okay, and then when you go to the constraint hypersurface, you have a dimension of, you have six, only six, and then now we want again to divide by the orbit, so we need to subtract six again. So we get six minus six, and we get zero. Okay? So here you get dividing by, so to get the physical, but let's see what we're going to get in 4D quickly, because here that's true that in 3D it's a bit, well, so we need to divide by the gauge orbit. We need to, we get 6 minus 6 is equal to 0. Okay, so let's see what happened in 4D, because here it's a bit, it's too simple. Yeah.
So this picture we get from one point in the gauge orbit to another by acting with the constraints, right?
Yeah.
That means we also get from one point in the gauge orbit to another by acting with the Hamiltonian, because that's just constraints.
Yeah.
So two configurations between which there's a Hamiltonian would also be physically equivalent.
Yep.
Okay.
But so we're going to come back on this because I know that. So this is the starting point for the, what we call the time problem in gravity. Okay. But I'm going to, maybe we're going to come back on that maybe more on Monday, because I think today, this afternoon, you have a tutorial. Mm-hmm. And during this tutorial, you should look at the case of the parametrized particle. So it's a very simple, the particle, the free particle is an example you know how to, in Hamiltonian physics, it's very simple to get its evolution and stuff. But here you're going to look at the parametrized particle to introduce a kind of new clock and see, and get a system very similar to what we have here, except that you know what are the physical system. Okay, so it's going to be, so once you will have done that, then we will come back on this issue of maybe time for gravity, because it should become more clear once you have done by yourself the calculation and understood what are the, what does it mean now to have this free particle with a constraint, which is a gauge constraint, and meaning that you're going to get no, an Hamiltonian with no evolution, which doesn't mean that you have a time evolution. So we're going to come back on that. But I prefer that you start by looking by yourself at this simple example, and then we do. So let's now just a few words on the 4D case. So I think some of you know what is the ADM formulation. Okay, so the idea of the ADM formulation is just that it's the canonical formulation for gravity, but starting from the metric formulation, okay? So the Einstein-Hilbert formulation. So at the end, on your hypersurface, you get as so basic variable, your configuration variable are going to be the special metric, okay? And so I'm not going to give you what is the expression of the conjugated momenta of this spatial metric, but it's just, well, yeah, from the action you get the, easily the expression. So now if we do a counting of degrees of freedom, here we have, so these are symmetric, okay, and A, B can take three values, it's a space indices, so you get 6 and 6 here. So here from this variable you get what we call again the kinematical phase space, okay? And on your kinematical phase space, you get 12 degrees of freedom. So now, if you are in the metric formulation, your symmetry are only the diffeomorphism symmetry. Okay, so you get H mu is a constraint, and it's generate your diffeo. So usually we make then the splitting between the spatial diffeo and H, the time evolution with the Hamiltonian. Okay, so here we get 4 constraints. So this means that now the dimension of your constraint surface is hypersurface is given by just 12 minus 4, so you get 8, is, so you get 8, but again these are gauge transformations, so you need to, again, divide by the gauge orbit. So you need to count twice. So in fact, when you have gauge transformation or first class constraint, the idea is that to make the counting of degrees of freedom, you need to count twice your the dimension of your constraint. Okay, so here, then you get that the physical degrees of freedom on your phase space, okay, on the phase space is 8 minus 4, and you get 4, okay? But this, of course, is not the number of degrees of freedom you used to, when you talk about degrees of freedom in space-time, it's you get this result divided by 2, because here, of course, you have the configuration variable and the momentum variable, so that's why it's double, okay? And usually when you talk about degrees of freedom, you talk only about the configuration space, so degrees of freedom is the dimension of your configuration space. So here you get 2. Okay? This is, so in 4D, it's what is, of course, expected. You get the 2 helicities of a massless spin 2 particle. Okay? Okay, so this is just for the 4D case. And now just maybe another word about constraint. So here we did, we have first class constraint, but be careful, not all constraints are going to be first class. And when we are going to deal with the spin foam approach in 4D, we are going to start with the Plebansky formulation of gravity. And in this case, we're going to get constraints which are going to be second class. Okay? And so when you have second class constraint, this means that when you look at the Poisson bracket of this constraint, what you get is not zero or a combination of the constraint. And this is the fact that in the Plebansky formulation, which is the starting point for the spin foam models, that we get second class constraint is what makes things very complicated to quantize, especially that in the spin foam approach, really we try to first quantize. We start with the topological theory, and then we want to implement at the quantum level constraints which are going to be second class constraints. Okay? Okay, so this was so maybe just a few words, because in 4D you won't have this, you don't have this constrained algebra. So here it's a nice algebra in 3D, especially that it reflects the simple flat dynamics of 3D gravity. But if you want, with this kind of algebra, if you want to have a kind of notion of time, you are going to get a quite weird notion of time, because it's going to go forward in some region and then backward in some other region. And so usually when we want to have a kind of a good time parameter, we go back to another formulation of the constraint, and we go back to the what is quite well known, which is a Dirac algebra, okay, which is a Dirac hypersurface deformation algebra. So I'm just going to conclude on this, because it's also the kind of algebra we get in the 4D case, and I'm just going to show you where is the why then we don't use that. We are not going to use that to quantize. It's because we see that, in fact, it's not properly a closed algebra, meaning that one of the Poisson brackets now is going to depend on the phase space variable. Yeah, I'm going to explicit that in a moment. So now we can look at the... So it's an alternative basis for the constraint, and we get the hypersurface. So it's so-called the Dirac. And it's quite universal, because you get this algebra as soon as you're dealing with a n minus 1 hypersurface evolving for n manifold. Okay, so it's quite hypersurface deformation. Algebra, and here the idea is more or less, so if you want to start with what we have seen already, is a kind of, you are going to project your flatness constraint on tangential, so if you look at your hyper, so now I'm talking about the space, your space manifold, so your hypersurface sigma, and now if you want, you want to project this constraint on the tangential vector and a normal vector. Okay, and you're going to get new constraints, which are going to be so what we call the special DFAO and an Hamiltonian constraint. Okay, so here, yeah, it's kind of flatness. So you can start from your flatness constraint that you're going to project on a tangential vector and a normal vector. So like this, you're going to have your DFAO, which are going to make now be interpreted as deformation of your, so you project this one. So on what you're going to call the shift vector and the lapse function, okay, and an NA. And so now you're going to get a DFAO, special DFAO constraint. DFAO constraint, which geometrically can be interpreted as really a deformation, tangential deformation of your hypersurface, and you get that. Now you get this. So this shift vector here is considered as a good parameterization for the for your time. It's a good time parameterization. And so you get that here. You get a normal deformation by the Hamiltonian of your hypersurface. But so if now you look at, so here it's going to be h of the shift vector, and here it's h mu h a of, so this one is tangential and this one is normal, and what you get as a, so the Dirac hypersurface deformation algebra is just given by, so two tangential transformation give you another tangential transformation, deformation. And you get that a normal one tangential is still a tangential and so in the 4D case it's this kind of algebra we get because in 4D we need to make the difference between the Hamiltonian and the, we have this splitting of constraint, the Hamiltonian constraint and the spatial diffeo constraint. And but you will see that the difficulty here comes from the fact that this Poisson bracket here is equal to h of v, where v now is a phase space dependent structure. And so this means that, and at this stage, we still don't know how to, so VA here is a phase space dependent structure, and we still don't know how to find a quantum representation of this algebra because of this dependence here. Okay, so here you get that this is phase space dependent. Okay, I think I'm going to conclude here. And so, phase-space dependent. On Monday, we will start with the idea of quantization of how you can quantize constraint system. Okay, because here we are really dealing with constraint system. And we will start, I think, with the parameterized particle that you should see this afternoon during the tutorial. Okay, so thanks.